It turns out the turbulence, as I'm sure everybody here has been participating in this workshop, those plays a very crucial role in the structure of the clouds, and as we shall see, in the formation of multiple star systems. So first, let me begin by giving credit to my collaborators. I'm going to actually try, it's a fairly ambitious program I want to accomplish today. I want to talk about four separate topics: the simulation of star formation, protostellar outflows, then based on this, determine the respective efficiency with which stars form, and finally, then using this data to see how star clusters might form. And these last three items were done in collaboration with Chris Massner in part of his, beginning part of his thesis. This first part here is done with a number of collaborators. It's basically the thesis research of Bob Fisher and a collaborator with Richard Klein, and earlier collaborators included another couple of students here, and then some people who brought them. So one of the first things you can notice, which I'm sure based on Yuri's talk yesterday will come as no surprise to him, that if I have this one quarter of my talk, which involves simulation, has a very large number of collaborators, which has the three quarters, which is really just thinking about things, only needed one. And it really shows, I think, the enormous amount of effort that is needed in order to go, develop a successful large-scale numerical simulation. So let me begin then with the simulation of star formation, in particular, the collapse and fragmentation of molecular cloud cores. And the problem I want to address in particular is, why is it that a substantial fraction of the stars that we see are multiple? Observations dating all the way back over 25 years ago show that more than half stars are multiple systems. Recent observations have shown that in some regions of star formation, the fraction actually gets up the order of unity. So there are two questions that we have. One is, how can you predict the multiplicity of a star system this form? And secondly, how can we predict the masses of the stars? I'm not going to be able to answer these questions today. What I want to discuss, though, is the work that we have underway now and the progress we've made so far. This, as you can imagine, these questions are fundamental to star formation, and people have worked on them for many decades, beginning with Richard Larson and his work by Bodenauer, Voss, Polina, and so forth. And this problem was idealized in the following way. If you imagine a gas cloud which has some temperature and a uniform density, and then you set up spinning, you can ask, it's going to be basically described by two dimensionless parameters. So-called alpha parameter, which is the ratio of the thermal energy to the gravitational energy, and the beta parameter, which measures the rotational energy over the gravitational energy. And recently, Cerruti and Inosuka have essentially summarized everything that's been learned about this problem in the last 25 years, and they've made progress on it themselves. And they basically, what they showed was, is that this parameter here has to be less than about a half if you want to get fragmentation. So in other words, if you have a slowly rotating cloud, or this beta parameter is much less than one, and as we'll see, that's generally observed to be much less than one, then that if they're marginally stable to collapse, in other words, if you have a alpha of order unity, they will not fragment. And I might say that recently my colleague at Berkeley, Frank Hsu, has carried out a number of theoretical studies in which he has looked at some detail at configurations, not round ones like this, the Hynek Platinum one, and has come up with the same conclusion, that if you have a very smooth initial density distribution, that you do not form a multiple star system. So naturally, this leads to the question, what's wrong with this picture? In other words, why is it that in nature, the clouds that we see do appear to fragment and form multiple stars? Well, we've omitted a number of effects. First of all, this work that I just described omitted the effects of magnetic fields. The effect this would have on fragmentation is uncertain. This work omitted the inhomogeneity of the cloud density, that is, at least in the simple work, which assumes that the cloud is uniform, has uniform density. When you include that, though, then you're going to set up density gradients, which probably wind up inhibiting the fragmentation. But the main thing we omitted, which is, of course, particularly relevant to what's been going on here for the last month, is that we omitted cloud turbulence. And as initially shown by Richard Larson in 1981, you have what's called the line-width size simulation. And that is that if you, as you look on the larger monitor scales, you find that the velocity that you see increases systematically with gradients. Now, this particular regulation I'm quoting here is based on looking at a sample of low mass force. So these typically molecular groups, pumps of molecular gas that have a mass of several few tens of solar masses, summarized by Casale and Myers a few years ago. And if you then revise this in a very instructive way, if you just take the ratio of this turbulent velocity to the thermal velocity at a typical temperature order 10 Kelvin, which is measured in these regions, you find that the Mach number then scales basically like the radius of about a tenth of a parsec for one hand. So if you're on a scale small compared to a tenth of a parsec, then you would anticipate that the line would be primarily thermal. If you're on a length scale substantially larger than that, you would have primarily non-thermal.
How is that measurement done? Just by having a larger aperture over which the line is fed into your spectrograph, or are you how are you assessing the non-thermal line width?
Right. Well, that's an excellent question. And so people have done two different things. One is to look at a single tracer and then try to actually map it. But oftentimes it turns out that lines are really visible only over a narrow range of radii. Because if you go to too low a density, then they're not bright enough. And if you go too high density, their collision is compressed. So the other way this is done is to then actually just look at what the line width is in different molecular tracers. And then you look at lines which are essentially primarily lower densities, and then as you look at lines that are progressively higher densities, and you wind up getting a ratio. I might mention that you get a similar relation if you then look, instead of looking at a single core, you look at different cores. And then different people who've done this, in fact, in Morris's original work, you got a somewhat smaller. So this, in different works, if you look at higher mass regions of high mass star formation, this exponent also seems to be smaller. But the basic point is, and everybody gets, is that on sufficiently small scales, which in this region of low mass star formation is like a tenth of a parsec, then you're primarily thermally supported.
And why is it physical that whenever you introduce in homogeneity, these enhancements that in the homogeneity is associated do not act as you know, seeds for further fragmentation? Why cannot
that's in fact and people do what will happen?
Ah, but you're saying that if in a
I'm sorry. What I meant there was just to allow say a radial variation.
Ah, okay.
So that wasn't clear. Yeah. So it was initially people just had a density constant, and if you allow for the mass density constant, that's what's in the direction. So in other words, what we have to do in our simulation is go ahead and allow these large amplitude velocity and density perturbation. And recently, Berker and Bodenheimer discovered an interesting fact, and that is that if you just go ahead and initialize some turbulence in a cloud, then just like randomly, you will wind up getting some rotation. And we verified that the conclusion is correct. Here's the distribution of this rotational parameter based on some data that Alyssa Goodman and her collaborators obtained some years ago. And you can see that it's highly peaked for values less than about 0.01, and then you get some tailing off here. And actually, this graph, we suppressed, there's one or two that are way out there, but we suppress them because I wanted to compare that with what we get when we do the numerical models. And we get, I would say, something that's qualitatively similar, but not in detail similar. You'll see that we also have most of our realizations are less than 0.01. We have a somewhat smoother and somewhat fatter, I would say, distribution out here. On the other hand, in reality, there are all kinds of effects that we left out, such as magnetic. So at least the just putting in, you know, turbulent velocity fields that we're using, we wind up getting a distribution of these rotational energy parameters that are comparable to those that are observed. Also want you to focus on the fact, remember this is the ratio of the rotational energy to the gravitational energy, and it's generally very small. So these are rotating much, much less than the breakout. Rotation is not that strong in effect. So the challenge of simulating star formation is truly daunting, because basically you have to go from interstellar densities, which are six and five, just so we're talking about scales of order 10 to 17 to 18 centimeters, densities of like 10 to minus 20 grams per cubic centimeter. And then you have to go all the way to stellar size scales, where 10 to 11 centimeters in density is order of grams. And this is, people have been able to do this in one dimension, but we want to do it in three dimensions, and so far that's possible. There's another physical effect which we're going to include. This is a highly simplified version of what actually happens. And that is, at low densities, if you're much less than some characteristic density, then essentially all the radiation from the gas cloud can freely escape. And it turns out that you get a balance between heating and cooling, and more or less keeps the temperature around 10 Kelvin. But once the cloud becomes opaque, it becomes more difficult to cool it. And then it switches over to become more adiabatic. Now, but really to do this, what you should do is do a proper radiative transfer calculation, which we hope to do within the coming year. So far, we've had to content ourselves with just trying to parameterize this. So we assume that at low densities, when rho is much less than the characteristic stiff density, then you have that the pressure just goes like the density times the square of the sound speed. So that's isothermal. But then above this density, you switch over to gamma equals 5/3. Now, the third thing I want to mention, which is, makes it more challenging to simulate, is based on the work that Kelly Trulove did for his thesis. And that is that you actually have to resolve the gravitational length scale. Now, if you think about this, it's sort of obvious in retrospect. It's interesting that people who have been working on this problem for decades, although once in a while you see some comment about how it would be nice to do that, no one ever thought that it would be actually essential to do that. And what we found was that in fact it was essential, and that basically, thanks to all the previous work, which has been done over the past several decades, which ignored this, this is a very challenging constraint, though. You have to essentially have your grid size be less than some number times the Jeans length, where the Jeans length measures the scale over which gravity can balance thermal pressure. And with the numerical coefficient of balance is sufficient, which I'll another one. Well, what this means is that as you compress to higher and higher density, the density is going up, and this your grid size has to go down like one over the root of one half. Whereas, by contrast, if you wanted to just follow a given mass element, that would be correspond to the size scale going like one over the root of one third. So this is actually means you have to resolve smaller and smaller masses as you go to higher and higher density.
If you don't, what happens?
Basically,
what
happens is, I guess I didn't bring a picture of that, you get what we call artificial fragmentation. And so if people were finding results that they would have something and they would break up, you know, even with relatively risk initial conditions, break up into a number of fragments that equal the number of initial genes. They had all kinds of things. And they also found that it was relatively easy to make binaries. And the problem is that there's actually a subtlety here, because the system is, in fact, gravitationally unstable. And what happens when you violate this condition is that your grid boundaries can essentially introduce perturbations which will then act as seeds in the way of the world. Whereas what we'd like to be able to do is to be able to put in perturbations, and as you'll see, that's what we do. And then those perturbations we put in will be able to grow, but those are physical things going around. So, the approach that we've taken to deal with this is adaptive mesh refinement, and this is based on the pioneering work of Berger and Holliger and Berger and Colella some years ago. And the basic idea in adaptive mesh refinement is to try to go ahead and introduce higher levels of a smaller grid just in the regions that you need. So I tried just before the talk here to draw an example to give you, show you what I mean. I'm afraid my artistic abilities leave a lot to be desired. But anyway, I'll try to, at least maybe you can get the basic concept. So the point is that this I'm now taking a two-dimensional slice out of a three-dimensional grid. And everything is rectangular. And then what you'll find is that there'll be some region where you will have some condition, such as the genes condition that I just mentioned, where you find that you need more cells. So you go ahead and you introduce, in this case, you find by a factor of two in each direction. And then you look at each of these cells and you see, well, do you need to have any further refinement? In this case, it was a region where you had to refine by further factors. In fact, in the simulations that we've done, we generally use a factor of four refinement in each step, and we've gone up to six levels of refinement in some cases. So
you then subsequently unrefine?
Yeah, so this is done dynamically. So that can evolve with time based on the calculation. And so basically, in order to follow the regions, I didn't think that's not right.
So do these regions stay more or less in the same fixed position?
Other than moving around.
So it's an expensive procedure from that point of view, that you're constantly adjusting.
Yeah, it's not
readjusting the grid.
It's not the major time sink that the trackers. So the previous work that we've done, so this was Fulop's thesis, and then we collaborated with Alan Boss. And as I mentioned, we found that most previous calculations that involve gravitational flats were subject to artificial fragmentation. And we actually had, in this paper we wrote with Alan Boss, we had a very interesting result. Because Alan, in fact, was one of the main people who've been doing these calculations over the past 10 or 20 years. So naturally, he was somewhat disappointed to find that perhaps everything he'd done was wrong. So he wanted to really find again at the root of what was going on. So he went ahead and increased the resolution of his fixed grid calculation and found that he got, in this particular case that he was looking at, which here had this alpha here of 0.26 and the rotation fairly tight, rapidly rotating 0.16. He found that this formed a binary. And we told him after he got that that he, because we could see that his resolution is still not the same resolution we have. He had to increase his radio resolution by a factor 4, he had spherical structures as usual, resolution by a factor 2, so that he could satisfy the Jeans condition. And after doing that, he didn't get a binary. So in other words, previously he had been able to make a binary, but the fact that he was getting one was just due a numerical artifact.
Why do you could make the levels by 2 to 30? Would you get tertiary and 4 objects? Why should you only get 2 as you make the resolution higher and higher and higher?
Well, in this case, as we made the resolution higher, the 2 went away and became 1.
2 went away and became 1?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. At low resolution, he was getting this pile to fragment into 2 pieces. When he did it at high resolution, then the fragmentation went away. So it shows you how difficult it is to get this correct. So the calculations we've done with our current student, Bob Fisher, have a number of simplifying assumptions. First of all, these are not MHD calculations. We have no imposed rotations. We're going ahead and following the Burkert and Bodenheimer result that we can essentially get the rotations of the system from the alternative. And then we're going to assume the cloud is near marginal spillage. So if we had no turbulence in the cloud and the cloud were isothermal, then this was worked out many years ago by Bonner and Hebert separately. And they showed that the maximum mass is gravitationally stable is proportional to the cube of the sound speed and then divided by G2 times square root of the density. So if you put in numbers, so here's the temperature of 10 Kelvin, here's the density that corresponds to one that we use for normalization, you find that this characteristic mass is about half the solar mass. And in fact, that's interesting because that is around the typical mass of stars that form. And the radius correspondingly is a little less than 10 to 17 centimeters. Now, what we've done is we want to go ahead and consider clouds that are marginally stable. And so what we've but now we're going to include turbulence. So as we include the turbulence, then we've included the effect of the turbulent velocity in evaluating sort of the turbulent version of this binary. So we have this turbulent critical mass, which goes increases by the cube of the Mach number, the large Mach number, and the radius corresponding to this is linearly the Mach number, the large Mach number. And then we go ahead and set this quantity equal to 1, a order 1. And then, as I'm sure that Eve has described to you, find in these simulations, whether you have magnetic field or not, the turbulence decays. And so although initially we can start off in a stable, it will evolve into a state which is not stable. Now, the turbulence spectrum that we put in is basically in Fourier space. We go ahead and assume that the energy per unit wave number goes like k to the minus 2. And then you can get the line with size relation. You can just go ahead and ask what is the square of the velocity on scales that are smaller than that corresponding to wave number k. If you go ahead and integrate this, you see that you get this goes like 1 over k, or in other words, the length scale, and this then you recover the sigma going like L of 1/2. In the case that if you wanted to consider different observed line size relations, you can see you can have this. Now, one of the simplifying approximations that we've made so far that we're now in the process of trying to get around is that we have introduced only velocity perturbations. So our initial state as turbulent velocities, which are driven by the but our density is initially completely smooth. We then allow the density fluctuations to evolve as a result of these turbulent velocities. The problem with that is that, as I mentioned, the turbulence is decaying, so that by the time you actually generate the self-consistent density perturbation, you know, things have already decayed so much, and it would be much better than our initial conditions to have self-consistent density fluctuations. But so far, we have not. In any case, you can see then that with this result, then we have that the class of fragmentation that we filed, because of this fact that we're using the self-consistent rotation, instead of depending on two parameters, it really just depends on one parameter, at least so long as we don't have to worry about this opacity factor. And that's this turbulent Mach number.
Have you worried about splitting the turbulence into a compressible and worse part?
No. Yeah, so we haven't really done that, so we just go ahead and put this in. I don't actually, we haven't backed it out then to see that after we've done put in the velocities, what the division is between those.
I don't think, if this is supersonic, it doesn't really matter.
Right, and as you'll see, well, we've considered both sort of subsonic and supersonic. Now I'm going to show you some preliminary results where we essentially have just taken density slices, and I'm going to look at several different Mach numbers. So here's the density slice. Where we have a 3D Mach number of 1, so a one-dimensional Mach number would be 1 over the square root of 3. And what you have here is the length scale swept from a little bit more than 10 to 17 centimeters. So this is a couple of 10 to 17 centimeters in each direction. And you can clearly see the imprint of the adaptive mesh refinement. You can see that as you go to these different colors, that we have some boxy like shape showing where the grid is changing the velocity of the wave refinement. And in fact, it goes all the way in here. Here's the density scale. The densest region here is around 10 minus 12 grams per cubic centimeter, which is about 7 orders of magnitude greater than the lowest density regions out here. And in this case, we're essentially forming a single Mach. So what we find is with a low Mach number, that we just form one object.
Is this just a portion of the mesh 3D?
Yeah, that's just a slice.
I mean, no, is this a portion of the whole simulation or the entire simulation? Have you zoomed in, in other words, to show
no,
us?
No, that was the,
that's the entire simulation. What is the coarsest grid size cubed? What is the resolution?
Okay, we start off at the lowest level at
64 cells. And 6
right, levels. 64 five. Cubed. And in this case, we did not go to 64, level 6. We, I think, only went to level 3. So here we go to Mach number 3. And you can see that you get considerably more complex structure. And although we have not carried this out to the final state, it appears that we're going to get a multiple star system, and at the very least, a binary from these two things. We don't know what the final, whether all these things will resolve into two separate objects or whether eventually. These are sufficiently separated by enough that we believe that they will remain as two separate objects. And I have to say that one of the limitations that we have, which you can imagine, is that as the density goes up, the time scale and the time step is going down. So it's really, we're dealing with Zeno's paradox. We can never actually get to the end of our calculation for the density, at least in this calculation, the density is increasing by that. And the time step is going to zero.
You said the same time step is used everywhere?
That's right. In this version. So then if we go up to 3D Mach number 5, you now have considerably more structure. This, because of this extra structure, the code we're able to run non-noise fine time. In fact, only about 100% of the mass is in very dense fragments at this point. But you can see the sort of filamentary structure, and you can see several different regions here and here and then over here, where it looks like fibrous
component. Why is the mass always in the center where you shift the grid at this point?
The mass is always in the center because the initial condition, we have the central density about 10 times higher than the ones. You start off with a shape that is spherical, and then we put in these turbulent velocities. So once the turbulent velocities start to go, it evolves into non-spherical.
But you took in the velocity as just define your, you know, the initial condition. You do not have a constant pumping here.
That's right. We put it in and then let it relax.
Okay.
Okay, so the conclusions that we can draw then, I think is an important one. These preliminary calculations then already show that the multiplicity of stars formed increases with the turbulent Mach number n, and we think that moderate values is Mach number we get in Mach number. Now, this actually, in retrospect, makes a lot of sense because, as I said, we're starting off assuming that the clouds are marginal stability. So the mass increases with the Mach number. As I increase the Mach number from 1 to 5, then my mass is increasing corresponding, and so is my size. And in fact, specifically momentum increases as well. So as the Mach number increases, we go from a case where if you have a very low Mach number, you just form the individual star. With a moderate Mach number, you form dimers. In fact, if high Mach number is a characteristic of star forming cluster, then it can be worth 10 or so. You're actually then at a region where you're going to form many stars, form a whole cluster of stars. So what we're trying to do now is to go ahead and develop these self-consistent density perturbations as well as the velocity perturbations so that we'll be able to follow these farther in time.
Could you do this in axisymmetry and get sort of similar qualitative results? I mean, basically, you're looking at one, two, and many, right, as you increase the Mach number. Mm-hmm. If I do this problem in axisymmetry, could I also see one, two, and that at about the same Mach number?
Well, it's not clear because, of course, the results we have here are very are not axisymmetric.
I understand that, but I'm saying, you know,
so
in terms of...
It's not clear.
Yeah.
It's not clear. That is, when people have done these calculations like this in axisymmetry, and then what they tend to find is sometimes you've got a central object and sometimes you'll have rings.
Right.
And then they wonder about what, you know, whether the rings are physically realistic.
But the gravitational field is very different.
Right.
So you shouldn't expect some merit,
with the same initial conditions at high Mach number, you increase gravity, so meaning that if you're not marginally stable, then you get only one object.
Well, we have not done a calculation where we assumed that we were already far from stability, because we're assuming that the you somehow managed to evolve smoothly from a condition where you were stable to this case where we're unstable. In order that people have considered situations where you might suddenly become unstable, for example, if you have a shockwave come by and suddenly compress the gas, but then and we hope in fact at some point to simulate that, but then we actually want to go ahead and put in a shock rate and consider that case specific.
If you radius scales with a squared of Mach number,
first of all, Mach number,
shouldn't we expect that we get stability of the whole computational box for solutions of large Mach numbers? Rather than formation. Shouldn't we have the...
Well, no, we just scale it so that it's always marginally stable. In other words, the mass and the radius are evolved with Mach numbers so that you basically are at the Monterey-Ebert mass at all times.
Ah, okay.
Okay, now let me go on to consider protocell outflows. And I think one of the most surprising discoveries in concerning star formation in the entire history of the study of the subject was that when astronomers went out to look for the collapse, which everybody knew would occur, they instead found what Anbart Simeon had predicted 50 years earlier, which is that there would be outflows. Now, in Anbart Simeon's case, these outflows were driven by white holes, and he had a very imaginative theory.
So we know that's wrong.
Yes.
You're from the dark side.
So what Chris and I did was we were trying to go ahead and simulate and understand the formation of clusters. We realized we really had to get a better handle on these photocell outflows. And observations show that typically for low-mass stars, you have winds with, that are collimated and have characteristic velocity of the order of the escape velocity between the star plus 100 kilometers per second. And these, initially the evidence was, took a lot of interpretation on the part of the observers to see. Now, it's possible to get very dramatic pictures which show these outflows. So this is a photograph of the star-forming region called NGC 1333. And one of the things I want you to notice, you have this sort of very bright region here. This corresponds to a region of nebulosity, and you have some massive stars that form through the ionizing band. No one's noticed that there's some regions you can look in, really, you can't see anything. It just looks black. So that corresponds to back to the molecular cloud, and there's enough dust in that gas to completely block all the background stars. And then if you look again, you can see these very strange things that, this red in particular. And they're in long, stringy structures, sometimes with some curvature. And I think if you look, there's another one over here, there's some over here. Basically, on this reproduction, and then there's some down here, there's some over here. There are many of these. And the whole place is just littered with these outflows, and obviously have a very a major effect on the evolution of this cloud. So these outflows then quite possibly will determine the efficiency of the star formation. That is, you have this gas and trying to have it collapse, but then we observe that gas is being thrown out, and as this gas is thrown out, it's going to eject some of the surrounding material, and in principle could determine the efficiency with which stars form. But it's extremely difficult to include this in the simulation, so that, for example, in the simulation that I described earlier, we do not have any process like that. In fact, I think it's fair to say that people have attempted to simulate outflows, but they always do that on essentially a microscopic scale and haven't been able to go from the large scale down to the small scale. So let me now summarize some of the key observational facts and what the explanation for these is. And the basic picture that people had evolved was that these protostellar outflows are driven by collimated hydromagnetic winds from protostars. And two of the major observational facts are, first of all, it has the Hubble law for outflows. This is kind of interesting. If you look at the outflows and look at molecular gas along each of those regions, you find that the velocity increases linearly with the distance from the source. This was explained by my colleague Frank Shu and his collaborators about 10 years ago. He made just two simplifying assumptions. First, he assumed momentum conservation. So here we have, I apologize for my cartooning. So here's a star. You have an outflow going out. And then this outflow is supersonic and supervolcanic, and it suddenly runs into the ambient material. So it undergoes a shock. And it's then driving a shock into the ambient medium. So the assumption is that all this swept up gas, both the shock wind and the shock ambient medium, is radiated and just collects in the same shell, and you basically conserve momentum. The second assumption made was that the density in this ambient medium goes like 1/r². And then what you can show is that, in this case, the ambient shock velocity is a constant. So if you just have a constant wind of 1/r² density, then the shock velocity is constant. It then says r is the shock velocity times time. So it just goes like, r is going very linearly by the velocity. You can then look, so that therefore this model that Shewitt's company did satisfied this Hubble law. Then there's this puzzle of how to explain how the mass in the outflow is distributed this function of velocity. And I've drawn this my cartoon here. I have it look like everything's running at the same velocity. In fact, what happens, you observe sort of a lobe that looks more like that. And so you have some gas near the star and it's slow, and some gas far from the star and it's fast. And you're like, well, how much mass is going at what velocity? And working with Frank was able to show that if you just go ahead and use this momentum conservation, and then you use Frank's X-wind model, which I don't want to go into here, but it's a highly elaborated model for exactly how this wind is formed. And again, assuming that the ambient gas is distributed as an isothermal sphere like this, but now they've made it a little bit more sophisticated and allowed it to be non-spherical, they found that the MDV goes like 1/d², and that was in accord with the observations. So these basic ideas then were consistent with the data. And what Chris and I showed was that these results, which Frank had derived for very particular conditions, in fact are quite general and seem to be a universal property of hypermagnetic outflows. And so we would argue that the fact that these observations can be explained by such a model is very strong evidence for this basic result. And so, in particular for the Hubble law, you can have any density, any power law density. You can, in fact, then let the mass loss from the wind be any power law in time. And then, because everything's going like a power law, you'll find that the radius goes like t to some power eta. In fact, you can work out what it is in terms of these constants here for the power law injection and the density profile. And then, if you just take the derivative, you see that the velocity goes like eta over t. So, once again, disproportionate r. So it doesn't depend on this 1/r². then Chu and collaborators showed that the density in the WIM goes like 1 over r squared times sine squared theta. And Chris and I showed, again, that this was a very general result. And I should mention that he had come up with the same result in some unpublished works that Chu did about the same time. So let me see if I can just, this is a somewhat heuristic argument, which is the one that we use. If you actually go ahead and try to work out all the details without making an approximation, then you can get into incredibly complicated things. Norman and Haveris have a paper that goes on for 30 pages, which is still unscrutable to me. Whereas here, we just have a few little arguments, and we should not get the right answers. That would be so much better. So basically, if you go far from the source, then the wind velocity will go expected for the constant. The flow, we assume, is applied to the radio. With this, you then, this is by mass conservation, and you find that, along any streamline, my density is going to go like 1 over r squared. Now, it's going to be important later, when I know what the constant is, but that is, if I'm going along this direction, it might be 1 over r squared, along this direction, 1 over r squared, and we're going to want to know how those different streamlines are related. But right now, we're just going to one stream. The field is wrapped up by rotation, so this should get b going like b phi, and plus conservation, then you can quickly show that b phi goes like 1 over r, again, at constant theta. So this means that the magnetosonic velocity is about constant. So if you just evaluate V5 over the square root of 4 pi rho m, you find both things are like 1 over r squared. What this means is physically is we have a wind, and it's basically like an isothermal wind. So the sound speed in this field is constant. And if you ask, well, what do you get when you get an isothermal wind? You find that the wind velocity over the sound speed tends to go like the logarithm of the radius. So that's basically a constant. Once you get to large radius, it doesn't really matter how to evaluate. And so that means you can now determine what the flow across the streamline is. So we have that rho and V1 squared, because V1 is going by some constant, the increasing log is constant, times the sound speed. So this goes like this. We can put that in. We find that rho and V1 squared goes like V5 squared. We now apply force balance across the streamline. So I'm now going to look at different streamlines here, the one going like that and one going like that, and ask how are those forces balanced. Basically, you have to balance the tension in the field with the pressure gradient in the field, and this is all the same equation. You find the d phi squared plus my formula of r squared sine squared theta. So we then, from up here, we find that rho and v1 squared goes like that. So we essentially determine how this rho and v1 squared varies not only along the streamline, but across streamline. And physically, as you see, r sine theta is basically the cylindrical radius. So what it means is that this wind has an axis there, like this point pointer here, and then the density is going to fall off like 1 over the square of the distance away from that axis. So what this means is these outflows are really like laser beam zones. They're incredibly concentrated. In fact, in this limit, before we put anything else in, there's a singularity along the axis. We argued then that due to instabilities, you would expect some broadening of this. So if we went ahead and added in.
Can you help us show us again what then leads to that collimation? I can see your...
Right.
Yeah. Why is it so... What physically makes it so narrow?
Well, it's dependent. Basically, I think it's this last step here where you're doing the force balance. But you need to have this tension in the field balance balance and the pressure. And so that means that you have this V5 squared going up one of our squares. And then these other arguments show that basically the density is going to go and scale over time. So what this means is, and it's interesting because many models, when people treated outflows, they just said, well, they may be collimated, but we'll basically treat them as the spherical approximation. You know, astrophysicists often use that as sort of the first approximation. So you get a sphere or maybe a cone. And the interesting thing about this, of course, is you can't do that. There's no scale here, so we can't. There's no cone-like approximation. Indeed, I remember Chris and I spent, before we understood what was going on, we kept on saying, well, there should be some characteristic scale. We just approximated it as a cone, and what is the effective angle? And, of course, we couldn't find it because there isn't one. So, if you then get a little bit more of an insight into this, this shows what happens. A key step in here, which I kind of glossed over, that heuristic derivation, was that you start off with a wind and it's coming from some range of radii, say in the disk. And then you look at it far away, it's over some much larger range of radii. And what this shows, so say radii from far in or out. And so if you imagine that this is over 0 to 2 up to 10 decades in this radius, this then shows how the rho and v1 squared at some radius grows with slant theta. And you can see that in the limit, where you the solid line is from your 0 decades, so basically it's coming from this one point, which corresponds to Chu's X-wing line. And then if you go to a very large number of disk radii, this limit large for science would get a great band of large ranges. But it remains remarkably good. And typically people believe that, well, if you're Frank Chu, you believe in the X-wing model, and then you're in the case where it really comes from essentially just a single radius. And I think typically people think that most of the wind would come from within a factor of 10 of some characteristic radius. So here's a comparison observations of several different sources. And so this is the mass as a function of the observed velocity. And then as compared to the velocity, and here you have to put in some characteristic velocity that the source is moving at. And so we had, although it wasn't, what we did was, as I said, is we assumed that there is some cutoff in this one of r squared sine squared theta, so there's a maximum. And that then corresponds to the maximum velocity. So you tend to get this dmv going like 1 over v squared within this cutoff, and you can see for these several different sources that it agrees quite well. And as I showed before, it agrees very well with the this Hubble law. So this picture then for the protostellar outflows, which has been really developed by a number of people over the past decade, I think is strongly supported by the observations. So now we can ask,
Chris, let me ask a question. So the field lines are, the field lines, the flows are nearly radial, right? There's no, okay. So, but there's many sound travel times across because it's a narrow angle relative to the time to get there.
Right.
So do you think there's just no instabilities that will occur? I mean, this is really a this is really the old magnetic collimation picture.
Exactly.
So there's no instabilities?
No, there are instabilities. And in fact, we assume, we have not analyzed the effects of those instabilities in detail, but we assume that they do exist, and that's what prevents you from having this one over r squared sine squared theta go all the way to the axis. So there are instabilities that essentially break that.
But there is internal shear.
You're wrong.
There's very little shear.
Very little shear.
Right. But if you look at kink modes, you find that it is unstable. We were talking about elements before the talk machine to do with also sausage modes. But the amazing thing about this is if you just then look at the observations, one of the surprising, I should say that when they were first discovered, these outflows were in the immediate vicinity of these protostars. More recently, John Dalley has got pictures where he's shown that in some cases the outflows extend for, this is up to 7 parsecs, where it's a source, and they're remarkably straight. And they're not dead on straight, but they don't wander all over the place. It's quite remarkable.
I think it's also true that axial fields will stabilize against the large scale modes like the kink and pinch.
They can help, right? And I should mention, in the X-Wing model, it specifically does have axial fields as well. In the other models, it's not really clear what the nature of the field would be.
And the other thing is that there is azimuthal shear which stabilizes against small scale modes.
Okay, let me go on because I'm starting to run out of time here. And that is to then use these protostellar outflows to go ahead and find an estimate of the star formation efficiency. And this, in a way, is setting a limit on because there might be other processes to go ahead and determine efficiency. And there are two separate questions. You can imagine a single core, which I've tried to do here, where, in fact, you imagine that the gas is already due to whatever rotation it has. It's kind of settled into a thick disk here. And the gas is feeding on the star, and then you have this wind blowing off. And then this wind is going to interact with what is brought here. You can imagine that the interface here, this is the interaction, if this gas here tries to get into the wind, it's going to be blown away, and it will be blown out instead of on the star. So that can affect the star formation efficiency. I can then ask, well, what about if I'm in a clump? So I have a bunch of stars and there's a single star forming. If I was in a clump, I might imagine that perhaps then there's not going to be this very clean relation between the axis, the direction of the outflow, and the orientation of the gas. So in that case, we just assume that there's sort of a random well, in fact, it's into the gas distributed around the star. So you have to distinguish between the theoretical star formation efficiency, in which you ask, if I look at the mass of a single star here, and I compare that with the mass of the star plus the amount of mass that was ejected during the star formation process. And that's sort of telling the efficiency that star was formed. Now, the observers, however, have something completely different to look at. What they do is they look at a cloud, and they say, well, gee, we formed, say, 100 solar masses of stars, and we see 200 solar masses of gas still there. And so then they would say that the observed star formation efficiency in that case would be a third. But in reality, what's going to happen is if they caught it right at the beginning where you had almost no stars, then this would be zero. And in the end, the gas would be gone, so it would be one. So this is something that might remain, could remain constant during the star formation process, but the operation quantity will evolve. So that makes it a little bit difficult to actually compare our results with the observations. Now this, I'm afraid, is a somewhat busy slide, but hopefully at least be able to get across the basic principle of our calculation. So once again, I have this picture of here's the star, and then here I'm trying to draw in the outflow lobe a little bit more clearly. And what I've done here is I've indicated this is sort of the edge where the gas runs into the molecular gas. Sorry, where the wind runs into the molecular gas. So you can see that we're here, I'm inside the cloud. And so I've carved out a little cavity, but nothing's escaping. Here is where this intersects the surface of the cloud. So all the gas that is in this region here has been blown out. And so the condition that we use to estimate what, how much mass is this that gets blown out is basically that the momentum in that solid angle is greater than the mass of the cloud in that solid angle times its escape velocity. And now we're using the fact that we just showed that the distribution of the wind mass with respect to solid angle goes like this 1 over r squared sine squared theta, which means that most of the momentum is going right along the axis here, and it's basically useless. It doesn't, because it's so highly concentrated, it doesn't really very useful in injecting stuff. It's only the stuff at the edge, as room is sort of logarithmic distributed, it's only the stuff at the edge that's really going to determine how much stuff is there. Now, the Conlon company used this argument for an isotropic wind, and we just equate it to say that momentum in the wind with the ejected mass times escape velocity, you can estimate what the ejected mass is. But for the collimated wind, as I just said, if you try to say, well, what's the total wind mass, then you integrate over this density distribution here and over the solid angle. And you can see you get this long wind. So basically, you have the momentum or the wind mass is distributed so between 0.01 radians and 0.02 radians, I have the same amount as I do between 0.1 and 0.2 radians. But it's the 0.1 to 0.2 that's actually doing the pushing here. And so you really only get a fraction of 1 over this helping you out. So the ejected mass is reduced by that logarithmic factor.
But you jet may be processed.
No, so we have not worried about that. And the in this case, that would come in, I should say, that comes into the state of zero, just processing rapidly. And the observations, I should have actually mentioned that. This is the observation we got had this theta zero in 100 for the radian and not some very large. So basically, we had a similar result to what they had, but it's just knocked down by this factor of the formation. So as a result, we get the ratio of the star mass to the ejected mass. Now, this comes down the numerator. So we get a star formation efficiency, which is substantially higher than that. So we define this one, this characteristic thing here as capital X, which numerically turns out to be about 0.3, and the star formation efficiency is this. So we've actually evaluated this. This is sort of the heuristic derivation. We evaluated much more quantitatively, and we did it for the models that Li and Chu developed, in which they considered a case in which you have a cloud that might have some magnetic support. And they consider the case in which these are self-similar. So you get a 1 over r squared density drop off in any x direction that changes, coefficient changes. So as you increase the field strength, you get progressively flatter distribution. And so the picture then, if you have something here, is just for gases. So that means the star, you get infall along that axis, and then the outflow is going there. Now we parameterize this by assuming for our models to assume that this ambient density goes like sine theta to some power. And so this shows them approximately what the results are, which will increase that exponent. So the result then is that the star formation efficiency depends upon the angle, this escape angle. And we have here for several different cases. So theta zero corresponds to, if you move the ground cloud, which the star is embedded in. Theta 10, which unfortunately can't see very well, line like that, and corresponds to something that's really very high in flatness. And you can see that in all these different cases, we use the fiducial values for the parameters of the temperature and wind velocity. We wind up with a characteristic escape angle of 6 to 7 degrees. So that means that basically you're blowing everything outside an angle like that that's ejected from the cloud. And this then shows you the corresponding efficiency, which varies from about a quarter to three quarters. Now, if you do this for that's for an individual core, if you do this for clusters.
What is your choice of state amount?
I said, yeah, it's 100 per radian.
100 per radian.
That was the one that gave the best agreement for data. This is now, if we look at a whole cluster of stars, and so now instead of looking at things on the order of the solar mass, we're going over to 10 solar masses up to 30,000 solar masses. And here we're looking at it as a function of density going from 10 up to 10 to 7. And then we can determine what the efficiency of the star formation is. And in this region here, we put a line which shows that actually if you had a large enough mass here, you would expect that you probably would have formed a star over 20 solar masses, and that would have enough ionizing radiation to really completely change the color. So this region above this line has physics in it that we haven't included. So we should really focus on this. And you can see that for star clusters, if you look at the conditions typical in star forming clumps, which are of order 2,000, 10,000, you're talking about hundreds of thousands solar masses, so you expect efficiencies of more than 30%. As I mentioned before, it's difficult to make detailed comparison of the observations because the people observing star formation can't actually directly measure what we're seeing. But at least this number of 30% is compatible with the result that they
get. I ask you about this 30%. So you're basically estimating how much of out of a sort of a great spherical cloud, which is perturbations, do you suck ultimately into your central object, and the rest you blast out, but to do it again or something like that.
But when this particular action was lasting with the 30%, I had a whole star, a big cloud, and I had hundreds of stars forming, and so this was how much mass was ejected from the overall thing. So 30% at the end, well, not at the end, but at any time when I would make a star, I would take 30% of the gas, make a star, and 70% would get blasted out of the whole cloud.
Why does it get blasted out of the whole cloud? Just because it has sufficient...
Exactly. It was able, it was given enough, high enough velocity so it had more than escape velocity. You're right, but that may go ahead and interact with some other cloud and make some other star some other day.
So, good, so the seed corn goes on.
Yes, right. But in that cloud at least it's...
So is that actually also accretive? It's a center object?
Yeah, we assume that either, that eventually all the mass is either accreted into one or more stars or it's ejected. Those are the two possibilities.
But in reality, it would have a fraction of
the mass. In reality, those are the only, well, we argue that those, that if you, for low mass star formation, those are the two things that can happen. I mean, it could go into a disk or something, but wasn't the disk then eventually accrete onto the star and some of it gets blown out. Okay, let me quickly now try to go to the last part of the talk, which is the part that is the least well in hand is for the silicon and contrast. But in many respects, I think it's the most interesting. And this is our attempt to actually try to go ahead and develop a model for the formation and evolution for the whole cluster of stars. And this is very much a first step of this standards problem because we made a lot of drastic approximations. Principally, in fact, that the whole thing is spherically symmetric, which we look at the observations as further symmetric. Now, there are three basic assumptions in our model. The first is that we need to go ahead and assume some model for how rapidly stars form, because once we're going to form these stars, then we're going to be able to include the effect of the outflows on the cloud. We have to know how fast the stars form. So we've just gone ahead and adopted a model that I built some years ago, which I call flow ionization regulated star formation. And that, the key is based on the idea that the rate-limiting step in the formation of low-mass stars is the need to have gas actually cross the field line. So if you look at the support of clouds by magnetic fields, you can potentially see that on small scales, magnetic, especially small scales, magnetic fields always come. And then there are one way, at least, to overcome that is to have the gas undergoing cold diffusion, so it's essentially under the force of gravity, right? The neutrals cross the field line and build up a high enough ratio of mass to flux so that then it can overcome the effect of magnetic field. And the assumption here is that that is what is limiting the star formation. So that says that in any mass element dm, you can say that the rate of the stars forming there is just given by that divided by the amplitude of diffusion time. Now, this amplitude of diffusion time depends on the ionization. And the ionization in molecular clouds is determined both by FEV photon and by cosmic rays. And in the region which is ionized by the FEV photon, the ionization rises rapidly from the value of the interior up to much higher values here. And the amplitude of diffusion time correspondingly goes linearly with ionization, so it shoots up. So basically, it means that the star formation is confined to this region. In fact, this, whether or not this assumption is correct or not, this hypothesis here has been observationally confirmed in some work that was done by Lee and Evan and another author. When they studied L1630, they essentially looked very carefully where the stars were forming and found in regions where the extinction was less than 4 magnitudes, which were the characteristic value of the estimated, there was no stars forming, and all the stars were forming in regions of higher magnitude. Even though this people may question the details of this theory, it turns out that the amplitude of diffusion time, the cosmic ray mass score, scales like one of the square root of the density, which is just like the freefall time. So just from dimensional analysis, you would have said that the star formation rate is going to be given by this. So I think the over scaling is, you can drive a much more general ground. You can debate about the coefficient that comes in the scaling, and you've made a particular choice. Okay, so that's the first assumption. The second is that we're going to use two equations, which, at least in this spherical symmetric case, have to be satisfied. So we're really trying to address what's going to happen in an extremely complicated case. We might have hundreds of stars from all these outputs, and it's really, I think, many years away from being able to simulate this. But when somebody does this ultimate simulation and finds out what's going on, this is going to satisfy the time-dependent variable theorem, because this is a true statement. So we're just using this. So here we have, you know, we're including the time rate of change of the moment inversion, the magnetic energy, the gravitational energy, and here's the work on the associated with the surface energy. Then we also are going to be able to have energy conservation. That is, we can write down how does the energy change? Well, it increases because I'm injecting all this energy due to these photostellar outflows. It decreases because there's a damping of the turbulence. And then it can also change because the ambiguity can work on the cloud. So this ultimate simulation is going to satisfy that as well. And here what we've assumed, now this ultimate simulation might will have much more accurate values for doing for these things of rays than just here. Here we've assumed that essentially all the shocks are radiative by the core. And so it's really the sort of the energy that you inject is governed by the momentum conserving. And then we've assumed that the turbulence is damped out in some number of eta freefall times. And the simulations, I think, in fact, in the latest paper that Deep wrote, my understanding is that this number is actually less than 1. It's between 0.4 and 0.8. So this number 8 here might be less than 1. As you'll see, we use the number somewhat greater than 1 in our simulations. So we have then those are permanent assumptions. We also have some temporary assumptions, namely that we've just assumed that the energy injection by the protostar outflow is a delta function of time for each output, rather than taking account of the finite time scale which is injected. We've also assumed that the stellar density follows the gas energy. So as we're going to see, this this whole cloud now is going to be expanding and contracting. And we're assuming that the stars move with the gas. In reality, we're following these equations here for tracking the gas, and what we should do, what we plan to do, is to have an in-body simulation to actually see what the stars do. Okay, so what do we find after we do this? Here, let me just show you some preliminary results. And here we have a 500 solar mass pump of gas, has an extinction of 8 magnitudes, which corresponds then to an initial mean density of about 4,000 particles per centimeter. We started it out of equilibrium. So here I have the radius of the cloud in parsecs going up to 1 parsec, and that's the black line. And here, down here is a time scale of millions of years, so it goes up to 6 million years. And so here's the pre-fall time initially, and you can see that it starts to contract, and actually overshoots. It goes down to about a third of its initial size. And then down here we have the star formation rate, so that's also here. This is the number of stars per 1,000 years. So the star up here is very small. As it contracts, then the star formation rate in the theory we're using goes up for two reasons. First of all, it's going to go up as the square of the density. So that's the one factor. The other is, remember that I said that you cannot make stars in the outer layers of the cloud because that's ionized. And so as the cloud contracts, the fraction of the mass which is in that layer shrinks. So by the time we get to this space here, that's a very tiny fraction of the mass that can't make stars, almost the whole mass can make stars. So the star formation rate here, as you can see, is going up by well more than a quarter of magnitude. And we're including then the effects of these outflows. So this essentially reverses the contraction and causes it to down. So in this case, it's contracted down to around a density of 100,000. And I think, in reality, this what's going on here is this first bounce, I think, is probably at least an estimate for what might happen. The successive bounces here, I think, are probably not very realistic, because here you're really depending upon the historical symmetry of reality, not the surface symmetry. So I think the subsequent bounce would be probably. Here we have probably the total gas mass, and here we have the stars mass. And you can see the gas mass is going down both because some of the gas got converted to stars, but then also, as you can see, significant fraction of gas disappeared under the ejector from the system.
And you assume the amount of the energy injected in this star according to the Fourier model.
Right. So this then is starting off from, instead of initial extinction through the cloud of 8 magnitudes, we have 30 magnitudes, which corresponds to initial density of 30,000. And now what you can see is that here again, you see the same characteristic behavior. We have this contraction, and then we have this star formation rate, and it just goes shooting up, and then starts to expand and goes down again. And the interesting thing is, I first presented these results at a conference in Japan about a year ago, and Phil Myers had just gotten some NICMOS data, and he, in this NICMOS data, had shown what that region in Lower Cucus where he found some stars that heretofore nobody knew about, but they were too early to see. And the characteristic density of those stars that he found was around 100,000 cubic parsecs. And so I thought it was quite amazing that this run, which Chris had provided me from his thesis, turned out at this peak here to correspond to roughly the same solar density that Myers saw in his observations.
So if you assume the finite
time
to form a star and outflow, what would be the minimum width of
those? Well, okay, so outflows are observed to exist over around 100,000 years, and so that would then set a form. However, one of the things we don't know very well is that the strength of the outflow seems to evolve with time, so they actually are stronger earlier in that phase and then they're gradually. Okay, let me, I want to mention one other thing before I get to my conclusions, and that is, here's what happens if we set 8 equals 1. As I mentioned, the work that even many, in fact, a number of people have done on actually modeling MHC turbulence suggests that eta may even be less than 1. So we went ahead and we stuck eta equal to 1. And in this case, what happens is you're sort of going along here, here's the initial pre-fall time, and then it just starts to contract and contract. The star formation rate goes up, and this goes to zero radius. I mean, just basically, this type of model does not work if you have this very rapid dampening. And I think I have been very skeptical of the results of these turbulence simulations because I do not understand how molecular clouds can be observed. to always be turbulent when the turbulence stands out and lets you run across the line. This is sort of, admittedly, this is a fairly toy model that we developed here, but this sort of is a graphic example of what can happen when you say that the turbulence stands out that turbulence. The model that I showed you before, which seemed to agree with observation, had say the damping times of a few freefall times.
The only solution for this would be that we deposit the energy on the larger scale, and it is transferred back to the molecular cloud.
Yes, but that's not possible because the damping is so rapid that essentially you get spatial damping of the turbulence just to get temporal damping. And that means that what you would do then, by trying to feed in turbulence from the outside, you would compress the clouds and drive them into clouds. So I don't see how that would work either. Anyway, let me try to then quickly summarize. So I began with talking about the simulation we've done of star formation using adaptive mesh refinement. And so far we've had to make a number of approximations in the northern magnetic field. We've assumed that the cloud is marginally stable to begin with, which I think for many cases, at least when you're not talking about further star formation, is a reasonable approximation. We've also assumed isothermal and then based on resource, we have no inversion. Under these cases, then what happens is that the results just depend on the signals and this field constant. So I think that just realizing this already is a significant step. And the preliminary results then show that as you increase this, you go from forming one star to line running to multiple star systems. I then summarized the work that Chris and I did on protocell outflows, where we generalized the results that Frank Hsu had found, and we showed that this dependence of the density on the radius and the planetary angle, the cylindrical radius, is quite general and it's not limited to the particular idealized models that you're interested in before. And we showed that this was consistent with observation. We then looked at the efficiency of star formation, and we showed that the collimation of the protostellar wind makes them less effective in ejecting mass than an isotropic wind. And therefore, the star formation efficiency is much higher than we would have gotten with isotropic. So, the previous result from the Conroe company, they had star formation efficiencies of a few percent, we're getting tens of percent, which is much more consistent with observation. And we showed, considered both the form of individual stars and four and clusters of one from the point. And finally, I talked about the time dependent formation of star clusters, where we included energy injection from the momentum-consuming objects in the battle path against the dissipation of turbulence. The particular rate of star formation we used was based on the polarization of the star formation. In our preliminary results, then we were able to show that the formation of a cluster is associated with oscillations. And in fact, I had an interesting conversation with the name will come to me in a minute, but anyway, at the recent conference I was at, who pointed out that this type of picture may have direct implications for the observational fact that massive stars seem to be concentrated in the very center of clusters. And there's been a debate as to whether this is due to formation or not. And people have shown that if you look at the current density of stars in the cluster, then they could not have dynamically relaxed. Therefore, those stars must have formed at the center. There's some process going on, which means that the massive stars form at the center. Whereas on the other hand, because of this oscillation, it could be that when the stars actually form, they form under conditions that are denser than what we see now. The relaxation time could have been shorter, and it's possible that the stars, did not have to form at the very center. In any case, this is just really the beginning of our effort to try to understand how the clusters of stars form. Thank you.
Chris, it seems to me that once you allow the stars and the gas to not move together, you're just going to get one shock in the sense that you collapse down, the ejection of all that energy will just unbind the gas and you leave the stars behind. For some reason that's not obvious. You sent all the stars back out, so you did a lot of work of the gas in terms of the physics of the energy you put out in protostellar outflow driving the stars out, which of course won't happen. So if you only allow the gas to get that energy, then it's urged to
As I said, I don't believe that is, I think the significance of our results has to do with this first bounce.
Right.
The follow-on bounces, I don't think, are physical, both for the reason you mentioned, also because It's not going to split this time. But in fact, because we have an ambient pressure, the gas will expand. It might expand a little bit farther than we had in the current calculation. But I don't think it'll actually expand that much farther than that pressure will push it out. So the main thing that will happen, I think, is that the stars, rather, see, right now we also have during the balance, the stars get compressed. And that's not going to happen really as much. And so we will actually get the stars drifting away. One of the questions, which I actually didn't, I should have perhaps highlighted, was that is an observed fact that most clusters are gravitational unbound. And so people have done work on this, and you can show that if you were able to suddenly get rid of all the gas, then if you have, you need to get rid of more than half the gas suddenly in order to unbound the clusters. Now, if you get rid of the gas gradually, in fact, it's much more difficult. And then if you take into account the fact that the stars have a velocity distribution, so no matter either, if you did suddenly get rid of, say, 75% of the gas, then that means that some of the stars are going to stay, but others will be left. And so exactly why it is that that argument suggests that essentially every star formation event should result in a brown cluster of stars for its observation of the is something we have to determine. And being, our hope is that by seeing the actual effects once we allow the stars to lie and see what happens when you have this changing gravitational potential with gas, that we want to see what fraction of the stars lined up in these clusters and see whether that would be developed.
That's to say that the mass velocity relationship actually is evidence against the Schuh theory, because there's a whole range of mass velocity relationships. Schuh had just taken one, and there were three or four about this mv going as v to minus 2, but there are many, many more going as v to minus 1, v to minus 3, and v to minus 4, which is totally ignored. And I mean, that's absolutely no evidence at all there. It's just chosen one or two objects which fit his theory, but the rest don't, and they're ignored.
Okay, the ones that we've been able to look at so far, as I showed, seem to work fairly well. So I would like to get the we should get the data. And I think insofar as the point that you're making is true, that's actually a very powerful point, because what the thrust of our see, in the Frank's original model, he made a very large number of assumptions. And so if you then said, well, the data don't agree with that, then you don't know which assumption to throw out. What Chris and I have shown is that, in fact, this is sort of a universal property for these hydromagnetic outflows. And so if, in fact, there are a significant number of outflows that don't agree with this model, then that, I think, has stronger implications than we've been just from looking at Frank's
model. So in your real image, quickly saw the cluster that was collapsing.
Well, wait, both of them. Or which one did you want?
One that doesn't collapse.
Oh, right, sure. So, well, it did collapse. The last one, it collapsed with the origin.
Right. So what I was wondering about, it's collapsing.
Oh, okay.
Not bouncing.
Not sure.
What I'm wondering is, and I've talked to Chris about this before, is there. So does the star formation rate increase enough that it freezes out at some radius? That is, if the star formation rate is large enough, then don't you end up creating, turning all the remaining gas into stars at some time?
The answer to that question is actually no.
And you have this vertical line there, so in the lower panel.
Right. Of the remaining gas, you're always converting it into stars at some fraction of the freefall rate. And that's a shorter and shorter time as the system condenses, but it's not short enough that you convert it all at once. So that what you have there is that there's a time after which the system has gone to zero radius to turn all the stars, but there wasn't a particular place at which the last bit of gas is turned into something.
Oh, but if it were more efficient, then you would. Is that?
Well, if this ratio between the star formation, if the stars could form faster than the freefall rate, then that could happen. But that's not true, and that's sort of dynamically impossible.
they form at the free fall rate, then what?
Then it's fine.
What are the most important terms in the Virial equation? Right, so you have pressure confined by the energy and the magnetic term, and you have, so what are the most, in particular, how important is this term relative to T and W?
Okay, well, it depends on the phase, because this term here is important in actually causing a reversal. Like Lars asked, what would happen if I lose the roll on forever? And we had a vacuum, then the principle might have gone forever. But we don't. So it's really becomes significant just, you know, as the term.
And would the dancing current
So we parameterize that for this unknown number eta here. And so in the first two calculations I showed you, we said a equals 3.
Right.
And then in the last one, we said a equals 1. That was one less than that.
But could you compensate by this small eta by the larger efficiency of the injection of energy by stellar outflows? Could you, because in this equation you presumably can increase the first term.
Right, so what we've assumed here is that this interaction between the outflow and the outer medium is momentum zero.
Okay.
And that I would think would get better as it got to higher density. So in fact, as it contracts, you can see, so when you're conserving momentum, here's the wind velocity, here's the RMS velocity plus. So actually, as it contracts, you are increasing the efficiency as the amount of energy for wind is going in, so your pi is the same.
It's not any way to increase it to compensate for very efficient turbulent distribution.
Well, you could increase the wind momentum per star. So if you just increase the wind mass for the star mass, that increases the rate of energy injection.
Yeah.
And then there are details of the way the energy gets actually incorporated into the turbulence, for which you have to estimate. And there's a factor of order unity that comes into that equation because of that.
Yeah, that's just factor. So, I don't know,
Let's
this work, as I said, we really only begin, so we haven't done a full parameter study. So as Chris mentioned, you could imagine trying to, increase this momentum for wind. On the other hand, we fixed this product here based on trying to get, do the calculations.
You haven't included an energy change term associated with the compression of turbulence. So if you took our work seriously, then you would...
That's actually in the simulations, but not in that equation.
Yeah, so we worry about that. I guess that there's something about the... Let me think about that. So, I think... The compression of the turbulence is just changing energy from one form to the other. It's not changing the total energy.
That's not an energy per unit mass. That's not
the
first
law of thermodynamics. Well, it is my first law, but I'm saying it's the total energy. And then if I have energy in the cloud and I change it one form to the other, it doesn't go in this equation. This is, energy going in and energy going out. And not. And so this is the total energy in the cloud, including the gravitational turbulence and thermal energy. And magnetic.
So presumably there will be emission.
Could you estimate with what sort of time scale are you likely to have some dramatic bubbly things to show from your AMR simulations, and what is the main sort of barrier to progress? Just people time or machines?
The main barrier at present time is that the amount of people. So we have, relying on the heroic efforts of one man to handle the competition. And so.
So how many hours are you working now?
So he's working very hard, and then one of the problems, as you know, because we discussed it yesterday, so the two problems, one is to actually get the code to operate, and then the other is to analyze the data. And analyzing AMR data has proven to be a particularly a difficult problem. And Bob came up with a very clever idea on how to do this, which we're now implementing. And as you can imagine, if you have, although my, I apologize for this poor graphic I had, which tried to show how you have a different levels of refinement. That was just a two-dimensional slice. So really what you have to imagine in your mind is a cube, and it's got all these other cubes that are sort of randomly placed, and in each cube of level one, there might be a cube of level two, and then in some of those are a cube of level three, and then you're trying to add up quantities, like say you want to know the totaling and the minimum. Well, you have to go in and be able to access these things all on different scales. And so what Bob has done is he's just gone through and turned all this very complicated data into a single line of numbers. And then you can just, you know, then he's going to go work now on just doing a nearest neighbor thing, so he can actually know how these what the neighboring points are, regardless of what level of climate they are for each cell. And then we'll be able to go through and determine like what things are maximum. We can do intervals now very simply by just running through this one string of numbers. But he's the one, this one person is the one that's having to do that. As far as we do have some very significant help, however, from some of the people I mentioned out of Lawrence Livermore. They have developed a graded transfer code. And so what Bob is going to do is take that code and then marry that with the ground. And so we're hoping that by this fall we'd actually be able to do a reference collapse code with graded transfer. And then we could get away from these artificial assumptions made on the equation, which is a really very crude
process. But follow up from what you were saying with the adaptive mesh grid approach is taken over from smooth particle dynamics, this type of...
I would say that there are two camps, and there are people like myself who regard any result obtained with SPH as something that should be conformed to the real calculation. And then there are those who carry out the SPH calculation.
I think the answer is yes.
Just remember, it's all on tape, Chris.
Yeah.
It's all digital, even worse.
Right. No, actually, let me then elaborate on that since I am on tape too. Actually, because I think that the basic point with SPH is if you put in enough particles, then I think you would actually get a very good calculation. And the problem with SPH is it is so tempting to go ahead and use an inadequate number of particles. Because no matter, you can use a very small number of particles and you get results that look very interesting. And then you can put in more and you can see the fine resolution. And if you actually go ahead and put in enough particles so that you're actually properly resolving all the scales, then I think that you probably get the very same, essentially just a different representation of how to simplify the equation. So it's really then an analogy, really not be so much as to one method versus the other, as to whether you use enough resolution. And just as I mentioned, for the many people who did not resolve the gene splice before, using regular grid codes, then they also had allowed themselves to be tempted into believing results that were inadequate and so on. And I think it's really important to somehow try to make sure that regardless of which way you're approaching the calculation, that you really have proper results.
But then there won't be a huge difference in computing requirements
exactly
between the two methods.
That's probably true.
Provided you do it properly.
Yeah, that's my feeling.